So good evening, everybody. Good to see you all. We are up to, I'm only going to make a small reference, a small little observation about something, and then we're moving on to another topic. But again, I want to paint a picture for us. In our exploration of moving through the prayers, we started at the base of a mountain. We did the morning blessings. We started creeping up the mountain. We did the section called Psukei Dezimra, going through the section that went from Baruch Sha'amar through Ashrei all the way through to Yishtabach. And that's where we ended. Here's a great piece of trivia knowledge. If you've ever wondered, where are the beginnings and endings of sections in a prayer service? The hint is, where does the chazan, where does the leader say a kaddish? I'm not talking about a mourner's kaddish. That's a unique situation. But there are certain, I'll use the real word, kaddishes, right? There are certain kaddishim that are part and parcel of the service itself. As long as you have a minion, you say the Kaddish, whether there's a mourner there or not. That is usually an indication that that's the end of a section. So it would make sense, therefore, that immediately at the end of our section of Psukei Dezimra that we've been studying, the immediate follow to finishing Yishtabach is for the Chazan to say Kaddish, which is in fact what he does. So that's a tip-off. Whenever you get to a Chazan's Kaddish, very often, I can't say without exception, but for the most part, it represents a stopping point and the beginning of a new section. This new section doesn't even begin by jumping right in. It gives us an introductory sentence, or I should say better, an introductory invitation. Everything we've studied till now, while the terminology was said in the plural, as all of our prayers are, this is the first time in the morning service where there's an actual invitation by the leader, by the chazan, to join in the service. It begins with the famous phrase, Baruch Hu et Hashem HaMivarach. Blessed, bless Hashem, the Blessed One. It's not a statement. It's an invitation. Let us bless. Baruch Hu, the U at the end, means us. We. Baruch Hu is an invitation. Let us all, as a congregation, come together and praise and bless God, who is blessed. As we've said many times, the word blessed means the source of all blessing. It's an acknowledgement that God is, and now I invite everybody. I'm not just the chazan doing this for myself, and I'm not going to be doing it for you either. I'm going to invite you to join me. Baruch Hu, let us all join together. I may be the leader, I may be the chazan, or, truth be told, where else do we use this expression of Baruch Hu et Hashem HaMavarach?
Aliyah.
Yes, when you get called up to the Torah for an Aliyah. That's correct. You start with Baruch Hu et Hashem HaMavarach. Come on, you know, every Bar and Bar Mitzvah boy knows that. Baruch Hashem HaMavarach Le'olam Va'ed Baruch Ata. Right, exactly. So Baruch Hu et Hashem HaMavarach, the Bar and Bar Mitzvah, or the person getting the Aliyah, is making an invitation, is offering an invitation that we, I may be the leader, I may be the one, the individual who's getting the Aliyah, I may be the chazan, but this is not about my prayer, but we, this is all of us coming together. And yeah. Number one, what? And number two, the other aspect of it is, you know why he's inviting everyone to join? Because I as the chazan, or I as the person getting the aliyah, the individual, can only accomplish so much. But we, if we join together, right? What do we say? The sum is greater than, right? The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. When we join together as a group, as a congregation, we can go higher and accomplish more than any individual prayer. And therefore, after finishing that section of Psukei DeZimra, we say, okay, it's time to step forward. It's time to take another step higher in our growth in our prayer. So hence the invitation of Baruch Hu Et Hashem HaMevorach. What do we respond? We in the congregation who are not the Chazan, we say, Baruch Hashem HaMevorach Leolam Va'ed, right? Blessed be is Hashem, the Blessed One, for all eternity. We make the declaration. Together, we acknowledge that you, God, are the source of all blessing. I'm just going to throw it out there for you. I don't know how you do it, and I don't know how you were taught or you learned it, but I do sometimes hear these young boys and girls that they do this Baruch Hu when they get called up for the Aliyah. They say Baruch Hu Ad Hashem HaMevorach, and then the whole congregation correctly responds Baruch Hashem HaMevorach Le'olam Va'ed. Meanwhile, this child or the person who got the Aliyah has been waiting, and when everyone finishes, they repeat and say, Baruch Hashem HaMavarach. That is not correct. That is not correct. Because as I just showed you, the whole point is that the chazen, the leader, the person getting the aliyah, is inviting everyone to join in acknowledging and praising God. And everybody does it, and you, the individual, don't join. That's not appropriate. It's we collectively will respond. And therefore, if you're next time you get called up for an aliyah or you're teaching someone bar and bar mitzvah lessons, teach them that that second line should be said in unison together with the whole congregation. And then the person continues with the blessing itself, Baruch Adonai Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Bachar Banu, etc. We good? Make sense? Okay. With that introduction, we begin two blessings that precede the Shema and one blessing that is after the Shema that will lead us to the final section, reaching the top of the mountain of the Shmona Esrei, the Amidah. So this section, as we're really more than, I would say, probably close to the halfway point, maybe a little higher climbing the mountain, after making the Baruch Hu invitation and everybody joining, it starts with a blessing. And there's, like I said, there are two of them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it just because we're already moving at the end of February into March, and I'm not nearly as far along in my curriculum as I had hoped. So I'm just going to make reference to the fact that there are two blessings that precede the Shema. One of them is a long one that begins right after the Baruch Hu, it says, Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who forms light, creates darkness, makes peace, and creates all. That begins blessing number one. It goes for about two pages until you finish with, Blessed are you, Hashem, who fashions the luminaries. That's one long blessing. There's a second one that talks about the great love that Hashem has for us and the fact that he gave us a Torah. Then we move to Shema. And that's really what we're going to focus on this evening. We're going to move right into the Shema already. Okay? I want to teach you an expression. I want to teach you a term that the Talmud uses to describe the essence of the Shema prayer. If I were to ask you, well, that's not fair. Let me just say it. Why would I even think that you would know this expression? If you know it, congratulations. That's very impressive, but I have no right to assume you knew this. Okay. There is a concept which we've talked about probably at this point hundreds of times, but I'm going to teach you what the expression that puts it all together. There's a term that's called Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. Four words. Kabbalat means the receiving, the acceptance of, hence the word, by the way, for mysticism, Kabbalah, because it's a tradition that has been received and accepted from generation to generation. It's a special, unique section of study that you can't just pick up a book and study. It has to be with some level of Kabbalah, receiving. Lekabel means to receive. So it's a tradition that is received and accepted from teacher to student. Okay. So these four words, Kabbalat means the acceptance of Ol, the yoke, Y-O-K-E, the yoke, Malchut Shamayim, the kingdom of heaven. It's the acceptance upon ourselves of God being the king of the universe. The essence of Shema, at least at the very beginning, what we talk about in the first paragraph, is an acknowledgement that God is king. And more importantly than an acknowledgement, it's an acceptance upon myself. How many times have we experienced in life of where we understood something intellectually, but we didn't internalize it and see the relevance to us? It's very easy to talk in theory, but when you have to talk in practical terms of where this is pertinent to me, whoa, that's much more difficult. I've shared this with you. They say that the shortest distance, Sid, the shortest distance between two points is what?
Straight line.
A straight line. What's the longest distance between two points?
Circle?
Nope.
No.
Between your head and your heart. That's the longest distance in the world. Because you can hear something, you can intellectually understand it. Yeah, that makes sense. But then internalize it into your heart, that it becomes part and parcel of you and your character. Oh man, that's decades worth of work. That's the longest distance in the world. What Shema is, and we'll see that right away from the first word, Shema. The word Shema means listen, hear. But I will show you that the word Shema really is not limited to just listening. Because we all know from experience, either with our children, our spouse, our colleagues, right? They heard every word we said, but they did not listen to one bit of it. Not one word. Physically, it entered the eardrum and it got funneled into the inner ear, but it did not actually be accepted, understood, internalized. As the expression goes, in one ear, out the other. You heard it all, but you didn't listen. You didn't internalize. The word Shema, and I'm not going to do it with you, but there are different verses throughout Tanakh where the word Shema, the root of that word is used, and it always boils down to either hear and listen. It means to understand, and it means to accept. It makes a lot of sense. Because the art of listening means you pay attention, you absorb what's being said, you try to comprehend what the person is telling you, right? A good social worker, a good therapist, a good counselor is somebody they talk about, they listen well. What does that mean, they listen well? I'm listening, but I'm not taking the words and internalizing it. Trying to comprehend what's the question that's not being asked. What is the person really asking? What is being the person really saying? That takes a level of Shema, of listening, understanding, and then accepting. This is why Shema is known as Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim, the acceptance of the yoke of God's heavenly sovereignty. The word I want to focus on for just a few moments is this word yoke. I just knee-jerk reaction. When you hear a yoke, what comes to mind? Probably you're thinking of an animal that wears the yoke as it is pulling the plow or whatever it is it's doing, right? It's wearing the yoke. Yes, that's what you're picturing? Yeah, okay. I mean, unless you have a different picture, okay. But that's the picture that comes to mind. If that is true, just again, give me your knee-jerk reaction. Is that to the animal, is it a hardship What does the animal think? Hardship. Yes, Muriel shaking her head. Yes, it's a hardship, right? The animal would much rather be free, independent, not burdened and saddled with a yoke over its shoulder blades. And right? Agreed? Any disagreement on that? Robin's not sure.
I'm not sure.
Sharon?
It's what he's used to doing. He's doing a service.
Yeah, he's doing a service. But how does the animal feel? Would the animal rather have the yoke or not have the yoke?
I don't think he feels anything.
Animals have feelings? Come on, ask Cody.
I know they have feelings.
I think most of us would go along with Muriel's understanding, and that is in that the animal feels it's a burden. It's restraining and constraining.
But that you said one time, and that's what's jerking me, because I think you've said that it's not, and that's what, but I don't know the details.
Don't hold me to what I said in another class. That's not fair.
Okay.
I'm not responsible for what I said earlier. Okay.
Okay.
But you're right. Whether I shared it with you or not, I don't remember. But if you were really to think about it, the animal is being asked to do a service. The animal is being asked to pull a plow. Which will make the animal's life easier to do the task of pulling the plow? Wearing the yoke to pull it or not wearing the yoke to wear it? The answer is definitively to wear it. It is much more comfortable, and it will be much easier for the animal to pull the plow while it is wearing the yoke, not when it's not. If it's doing it carefree, it can slide. It's pulling one side over another. If it's not sitting right, the harness, the yoke allows the animal to carry on its task much more easily. Now, you're right. If you want to argue and say the animal would rather not pull the plow at all, that's true. That I won't disagree with. But if the animal is to do the task, if the animal is going to do that service, then wearing the yoke is making, again, assuming it fits comfortably and it's the right fit, the right, all of that, it will make it easier to pull the plow, much more than it be without. The terminology of our religion is that we are being asked to do a service. We are being asked to do a task here on earth. We are brought into this world for a reason. As we've said many times, if I am alive today, it's because God still has something for me to do. Those who've passed on did their service. But I'm here. That means I'm here still. My job is still to pull the plow. I hope it's not as menial as that, but there is a task for me to do. If there's a task for me to do, then I want a yoke. I want something that fits well, that will allow me in the most easy and productive manner to accomplish that task. If one looks at the Torah in that light, that the Torah is acting as our yoke, it means that the Torah is giving us the ability, when I live my life according to those guidelines, it's giving me the ability to live my life to the fullest so that I can do the task that I'm destined to do. If you want to ask me, can I get out of the task in the first place? That's a fair question. But that begs the bigger question of why am I here? Good luck answering that. But if we come to at least some level of understanding that we are here for a reason, God has a task for each one of us, then it would make so much sense that God gave us a facilitator, something that will allow us to accomplish that task that without which would be so much more difficult. The Torah, living under those God-given rules, is the yoke that helps us accomplish in this world. it enables us to use whatever natural abilities we have, natural strengths that we have, to serve God in the way we're meant to do it, with the maximum of ease, minimum of difficulty. I know that for those who may not have been brought up with this mentality of what a Torah life can do, it sounds strange. It sounds almost wrong, because we're brought up thinking that the Torah is a book of do's and don'ts, and there's a lot more don'ts than do's, and it's restrictive, and if only I didn't have to. It's not true. It's really not true. Having a Torah is what allows us the ability to soar higher than we could without, because I'm given guidelines. Imagine you're thrown into a maze. You know, one of these, I love these, you know, they make them at November time, these corn mazes, October time, right? They corn mazes, and you have to work your way out of a tricky maze, right? Imagine you have one that's really difficult, and it's at night. And it's at night. Can't use flashlights. You can imagine groping around in the dark to try to figure out how to work your way and maneuver through this maze is treacherous. But imagine you had the good fortune that there was somebody who was sitting on a lifeguard chair higher than all of the bushes, all of the stalks of corn, who can see the global picture, who sees the whole maze. And you know what? He's communicating with you, and he hands you at the beginning, here's a map. I've seen the whole maze. It may be dark and it may be hard, but you know that if you walk this way and then shortly thereafter you make a left and walk, don't go to the next path, but it's the one afterwards, you have to turn right, and you have the map, how to traverse this maze and get through it. That's what the Torah is for our life. Torah is the map. Because imagine you had to grope your way through the darkness of life without any guidelines, without any way of figuring out right and wrong, how to have relationships, what's the best way to utilize it, how to remain pure and ethical in an unethical world of business or whatever. It's hard. Not to say it can't be done, but which is easier, when you're given a map or when you have to figure it out on your own? Obviously, when you have a map. This is why the Torah is referring to it as accepting upon ourselves the yoke of God's sovereignty. Not because it's meant as a burden that weighs you down, but just the opposite. It's the facilitator that allows you to pull your weight, to pull your load of what it is you're here to accomplish in the world. That's what allows you to do that. The reason I bring this up is because that is what Shema is. The Shema, not just the first sentence, but the whole first paragraph, and even afterwards, the whole Shema really is known as the acceptance of the yoke of God's sovereignty. Now we can approach this, right? With that as an introduction, let's at least start. I figure we'll spend at least this class and the next on Shema, maybe even a little more, because it really is, if you had to pick a sentence that is the basic creed for the Jewish people, it's Shema. So let's talk for a moment. Shema Yisrael. Listen, pay attention, understand, internalize, and accept. Yisrael. For now, I'll translate it as the Jewish people. Shema Yisrael. Listen, Jewish people. Hashem, spelled Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, God's tetragrammaton, right? The ineffable name. Eloheinu. Our God, again, Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, the word Echad, God is one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. God is one, right? We're familiar with that. No shockers there. I didn't add any words. I didn't subtract any words. Where does this come from? Where does this sentence come from? Who made it up?
Wasn't it... Who was the son of the Well, I always thought it, when I said Israel, I always thought it referred to the person whose name was Israel.
Jacob?
And I thought Jacob. I thought it was Jacob. I thought it was spoken to him by his son.
Okay, we'll get there. Hold on, Fred. We'll get there. That's going to be option two. Let's deal with the more obvious option. It's not talking about Jacob or his code name of Israel. It's more likely referring to the Jewish people. Listen, Jewish people. Here is the motto. This is the creed for us. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is, Lord is our God. God is one. Who said that? Who's attributed? Who gets that credit?
Moses.
You don't saying it with not a lot of conviction there.
Because I'm not sure. Oh. I mean, I'm thinking, who would have
the only Michelle, person? Your hands up. Sid?
No, I was holding my head, but wouldn't it be Abraham?
Are you asking me or telling me?
I'm telling you.
You're telling me? Well, that sounds like a funny way to tell it. Because it sure sounded like there was a question mark at the end of that.
Well, I mean, he was the one who said that there's one God.
Okay. Any other options?
I was going to say Moses, but because the only one I could think of that would have addressed the entire nation, Jewish people.
That's a nice logical approach. I like it.
Probably wrong. But
Candy, who do you vote for? Fred or Michelle? Those are your two options right now. Michelle? Really? That's where your friendship lies. Okay.
I said Michelle 100%.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that you have a very strong friendship with Michelle. The bad news is you're both going down together.
Could it be somebody that came out to curse the Jewish people?
No, that's a good one. You're talking about Bilam, and that's a different
verse. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But Fred is right. This is actually a sentence in the Torah itself where Moshe is addressing the Jewish people towards the end of his life. And he says these words, Shema Yisrael, listen, Jewish people, if I leave you with no other message, please walk away with this one. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is our God, God is one. It originates from Moshe. However, Fred is also right in that on a deeper level, the Midrash, this is not in the text of the Torah itself, but the Midrash tells us that when Jacob was on his deathbed, we're told that he wanted to share certain secrets about the future to his children. He gathered around all of the sons that he had, and he wanted to share with them. And right before he was to do that, he felt the divine presence, that godly spirit that had been with him all that time, departing. And he took that as a sign that his children maybe are not worthy of hearing secrets, of hearing things about the future. Maybe he felt that maybe at least one of them was unworthy. And therefore he held back. And the children, sensing that their father was hesitating about telling them something important, uttered the phrase, Shema Yisrael, listen, Dad. Yisrael is the name for Jacob. Listen, Dad, we too believe Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem is our God. Hashem Echad, we believe God is one. No, Dad, don't worry. All 12 of us are on board. We share the same beliefs, the same faith. To which Yaakov responded, Baruch Shem Kivod Malchuto Li'olam Va'ed. The second line of our statement of Shema, Baruch Shem, blessed is the name of his glorious kingdom for all eternity. Yaakov Yisrael looks up and he says, Ah, Baruch Hashem, my children are following in my footsteps. The Talmud asks, we want to now incorporate the Shema into our prayers, but now we're stuck between the rock and the hard place. Why? Because if we say that we're supposed to phrase the Shema and the response the way Jacob did it, then I should say the first line, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And then out loud, I should say Yaakov's response of Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. But on the other hand, when Moshe said Shema, much later in history, the one that's recorded in the Torah, it was just the one sentence of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, without the response of Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. So the Talmud says we're stuck. If we put it as part of the service, then that's going to be a slight to Moshe. And if we leave it out of the service, it's going to be a slight to Jacob. I don't want to slight either one of them. What do I do with this second line of Baruch Shem? So the Talmud tells us what we're all familiar with, is that we say it, but we say it quietly. That's the one of the reasons why. We say Shema out loud, because that everybody had that version. But the next line of Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed, we say it quietly. We acknowledge it was said, but we're not going to go ahead and rub it in Moshe's face. That's what the Talmud uses as a compromise, how to deal with it. Now, it's interesting. There's actually a second source for that second line of Baruch Shem. The Midrash tells us that when Moshe, when he went up to heaven, so he heard the angels. He heard the angels praising God. And one of their expressions that they used was this line of, blessed is the name of his glorious kingdom for all eternity. Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. It was from the angels. And Moshe went ahead and he stole it. And he said, this is great. But now he was in somewhat of a quandary. Because to say it out loud, we're not really worthy of it as people, because you're using some kind of angelic formula. And, you know, truth be told, most of us, present company excluded, we're not angels. We're really not on the level. And, you know, it's not appropriate for us to be singing praises the way the angels do it. We're not angelic. We're human. He gives the
analogy.
There
is one time we say it really loud, right?
I'll get there. You're on it, Sharon. You're good. Hold on. Right? The analogy that's given, it's not great, but I like it, right? It's like a guy who breaks into a jewelry store and steals a piece of jewelry. Sorry, not from a jewelry store. He breaks into the royal treasury. Sorry, the king's palace, right? And he steals a piece of jewelry from the king's treasury. And he brings it home to his wife and he says, honey, this is for you. I want you to enjoy it. Wear it in good health. You're worth every bit of it. Just don't go outside with it. Right? You can't wear it in public. I'm sorry. You know, that's what it's like. Moshe's like, I stole this great praise that the angels use, and it's fabulous. But don't say it so loud. You know, don't bring attention to it. Don't wear it out in public. And therefore, we say it quietly. However, Sharon is correct. You all are very familiar that one day a year, once a year, we actually say this second phrase of Baruch Shem out loud, not quietly, one day a year. That day is Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, when we say the Shema, we say the first sentence out loud, and we say the second sentence of Baruch Shem out loud as well. Why? Now answers the Medrash, because on Yom Kippur, we are elevated in many, many ways, like the angels. We don't eat and drink. We are dressed in white. There's a whole slew of things that we do on Yom Kippur that make us seem much more angelic. And we try that. Once we're in angel mode, we have the right to say Baruch Shem. That's like we're up there with the angels wearing the necklace out in public together with all the other royal treasury. Beautiful idea. Okay. So we've addressed the word Shema. We've addressed the word Yisrael. Then we have Hashem and Elokeinu. I know we've spoken about it in the past, but just a quick review. Typically speaking, the names for God represent different attributes, different characteristics as we perceive God. Again, as we will say at the very end, where we say Hashem Echad, God is one, doesn't mean one, is not limited to one versus two, but one as in indivisible. God is not comprised of components. He doesn't have a merciful side and a strict justice side. That's not how it works. It's indivisible. Okay? That's part of what is incomprehensible to us. But the way we perceive God, we perceive him based on characteristics. So the name Hashem, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, represents God's attribute of mercy, whereas Elohim, Elokeinu, our God, is the term that's used to represent God's attribute of strict justice. And the two seem to be mutually exclusive. They seem to be at odds with each other. If I'm in mercy mode, I'm not going to come down hard on somebody with strict letter of the law. I'm going to give you the benefit. I'm going to be more merciful, compassionate, and give you more and more and more chances. If I'm going to look at things from a strict justice, I'm going to come down and lay down the law. You can make all the emotional pleas you want. This is what the law states. When a person gets pulled over for speeding, you can try. You can try and go ahead and say, oh, but officer this, that, and officer this, that. You can try. But at the end of the day, if he says, I'm sorry, strict letter of the law, that's what it is. You can try your luck again with the judge. That's fine. But you're tapping into the judge's mercy. But it's not the attribute of strict justice requires you get the blasted ticket. That's the fact, Jack. So here it is. We're describing God in what seems to be two conflicting terms. Hashem, merciful. Elokeinu, strict justice. So how do we end? Oh, don't worry. Hashem Echad. God is all one. What does that mean? Simple understanding. God is one. There's no other gods. Singular, monotheistic, one God overseeing everything. That's the simple understanding. Second understanding I mentioned is that God is indivisible. What that means then is that even when God utilizes strict justice, it's for mercy's sake. You say, how is that possible? If you've ever gotten a ticket for speeding, you know that at least for the next little while, you do slow down because you don't want to get another one, because then your insurance, besides being expensive, goes through the roof. But it works. So yes, the cop may have been nasty. The cop may have been doing it for reasons that they need to meet their quotas or whatever it is. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that when the parent, or in this case, the police officer, is giving the ticket, essentially, really what's going on behind the scenes is that they want you to slow down for your sake. It's for your safety. Now, you can argue and say that's not true, because if they really wanted that, they'd raise the speed limit, whatever. The point being, picture it as coming from a parent who punishes a child is because the parent wants the child to be better. Ultimately, it's for the benefit of the child, even when the child has to be punished, put in timeout, grounded, phone taken away, whatever. It's not because the parent wants to come down hard on the kid for the sake of coming down hard, but because I care. That's why. So even when the parent is meeting out strict justice, it's because what's motivating is the mercy, because you want the child to be better. That's really what you want. You care about the child. God is no different. Even when we go through challenges in life, and what seems to be the modus operandi is Elohim, the strict justice, don't ever forget, ultimately, it's Hashem Echad. All of it stems from one God who at the core of everything is merciful, even when meeting out strict justice. Okay. Shema, we did. Yisrael, we did. Hashem, we just did. Elokeinu, we did. And Hashem Echad, we're great. We got this all. Except for one more thing. If you look in the Torah itself, where this verse is written, you'll note that the last letter of the first word, Shema, the Ayin, is made larger than others. And the Dalid of the last word, Echad, is one. The Dalid is also larger. It's physically larger than the other letters of the sentence. Why? Different answers are proposed. The Talmud gives one answer. Either because it spells the word aid. Ayin Dalet spells the word aid, which means witness. And that is, this is a form of testimony. I, the utterer of this statement of Shema Yisrael, am testifying to the fact of my belief, Hashem Echad. There is one God and one God only, that God is indivisible and that God ultimately is merciful, etc., etc., etc. However, Rabbi Hirsch, one of my favorite commentators, points out something interesting. He says that the Dalid, right? What's a letter that looks similar to the Dalid?
Resh.
Resh, that's correct. The Resh is completely rounded at the curve, at the turn. The Dalid, while it also is a horizontal line and then a vertical line, it's sharp turn. It's not rounded, right? It's like the difference between coming to a complete stop and a rolling stop. Right? Rolling race, you know, you're okay around it. The Dalit is you're going, stop, turn, and go. Okay? Says Rav Hirsch, the reason why the Torah wants to make the Dalit larger is that you not confuse it with a race. Because if it's just like any, you know, just the regular same letter, same size as the other letters, and you're reading it quickly, you might see it as a resh. Now, if you read it and say it as a resh, wow, you will have changed the meaning of this verse as drastically as possible. You will be saying, listen, O Israel, Hashem is our God, Hashem Acher, another God. Ouch! The word Echad, which means one God, just got switched to Acher, another God. Okay, that is what we call heresy 101 in the Jewish religion. Okay, so that's the Torah wants to emphasize that it is not a resh, but rather a dalid. Okay, but wait, Rav Hirsch is also bothered. Why was the ayin in the word Shema made big? Ayin isn't going to be necessarily confused by the way it's shaped. Well, it's then you're not going to confuse it necessarily with another one. So why would the Torah make the ayin of the word Shema large? Again, Rav Hirsch digging deep says, because if it was spelled with a letter that sounds like the ayin, there's another letter. What letter sounds like the ayin? I'll start easier. What sound does the ayin make?
Isn't it a silent letter?
It's a silent letter for the most part. And what's another silent letter you're familiar with?
Aleph.
An aleph. So Rav Hirsch says that maybe the Torah is trying to emphasize that it's spelled shin mem ayin and not shin mem aleph. You say, what does shin mem aleph spell? It spells the word shema, which means maybe. Perhaps. Can you imagine now? This is now the creed of the Jewish people. Maybe, Israel, maybe Jewish people, God is our God. Maybe he's one. Yeah. How's that going to go down as for our theology, right? Perhaps God is one. Maybe. I'll take it under advisement. Thanks, Moses. Right? Clearly, that's a no-no. And therefore, Rav Hirsch suggests that the Torah purposely makes the ayin large to say, Shema, it's an ayin, which means listen, hear, understand, comprehend, accept. It, don't confuse it with an aleph. That's what Rav Hirsch writes about the letters ayin and dalet. Okay. One more thought. Rashi's understanding of this sentence is different than most other commentators. Most commentators translate it the way I have been all evening, of where it's a statement. Listen, Israel, fact, Hashem is our God, God is one. Rashi learns it differently. Rashi understands it as, listen, Jewish people, for now, Hashem is our God. But in the future, ultimately, Hashem Echad, God will be one and acknowledged by everyone. You hear that nuance of difference? How I'm translating it? Till now, I'm just translating it as a statement of fact. Listen, Israel, Hashem is our God. God is one. Fact. This has it as it's here's the facts of now, the current situation, with an understanding of what will ultimately become. Not yet. Something in the future. That's how Rashi understands it. Shema Yisrael, listen, Jewish people. Hashem now, currently, is only Elokeinu, our God. We are the ones who acknowledge Hashem. But ultimately, this is the unspoken part of the sentence, ultimately, Hashem Echad, God will be recognized by all as the one true God. Where we're familiar with this concept is that, as I've said many times, the last sentence of Aleinu, the Ne'emar, V'haya Hashem L'melech, and it will be, it's future tense, because we always talk about that day when ultimately Hashem will be recognized by everyone. Okay? So, summarize very quickly. When tonight or tomorrow morning, when you say the Shema, ladies and gentlemen, keep the following five things in mind. Here's what you need to remember, right? These are T's top five. Number one, Shema, hear, understand, and accept that this is what I believe. Yisrael, I'm talking that I'm part of the whole Jewish nation. It's not just my belief. We all believe this. This has been the motto of the Jewish people since the beginning. Hashem, the God who was, is, and always will be, is Elokeinu, our God, aware of us, cares about us, and ultimately Hashem Echad. God is one now, in the future, always caring, compassionate, even when he's strict justice. Ultimately, it is the God of oneness. All that in 4 seconds or less. And go. No.
I'm sorry, I think I got 1, 2, 3. I was confused with the difference.
1, hear, understand, and accept.
Got that.
2, Jewish people.
Right, 3.
3, God, Hashem, who was, is, and always will be. 4 is our God, aware of everything and is ours. And 5, Hashem Echad, right? Now is for us, but ultimately will be for all. This indivisible one God who cares about us. Those are the 5 points. And folks, if it takes you 40 seconds or it takes you 4 minutes, no rush. Whatever it takes, because this is the phrase that pays. This is it. This is the line that is the most critical of the Shema. In fact, the halacha is, and I'll end with this. Sometimes when I go to shul on Shabbos, so my walk from my house to my shul is about, I don't know, 12, 13 minutes. So depending on what time it is, I like to say the morning blessings as I'm going. I sometimes stay in bed a few minutes too long and I have to rush to shul and I want to say it on my way. So there's a section, whatever, where I say the Shema. I say the Shema. The halacha is that if you're walking along, you know, and it's time for you to say the Shema, or you want to say Shema, you are obligated to stand in place when you say the first sentence. You can't continue walking. Why? Because this is the sentence that requires your full attention, your full focus and concentration on what it is you're saying. Now, it's true. You can argue and say, Rabbi, shouldn't that be true for all the prayers? The answer is yes. But there is a hierarchy, and the level that requires your total focus is the line Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, on what is being said, what we're trying to convey. You have to stand. And I'm sure if somebody were walking, you know, a block or so behind me and sees me doing my pretty quick pace, and all of a sudden I stand there, put my hands over my eyes, I stand there for whatever, a few seconds, he must think I have this massive migraine every Saturday morning. It's like, and almost in the same spot every week, you know? Okay, something up with him. Okay, have a good Shabbos. Move on. But that's what it requires. Yes, Robin.
So putting the hands over the eye, that's for focus. Where did that start? Or did we have time to get into that?
Good question. So I'll give you two quick answers. Number one is because that's a way of focusing. We have this tendency to, our eyes get distracted and we start, you know what? If this is really the critical sentence of the day, close your eyes, cover your eyes, don't get distracted. That's the simple understanding. However, if you want to understand it on a deeper level, let's go back to what we said before. Hashem versus Elokeinu, right? On the surface, it looks like that there's two conflicting characteristics. And in fact, the truth is that if you look at the world in which we live, it is a world of duality. There's everything in the physical world has itself and a complement. There's nothing that's singular in our world. Nothing. Day, night, male, female, everything. Because that's the way God created our universe, that it should have duality. So that there is two options. We always come back to this. If there's free will, you got to have two options. So the world is built on a premise of multitudes, more than one. You know what we do, Robin? When I'm saying the Shema and I'm making the declaration, there is only one God. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to cover my eyes with my hand and say that which my eyes see in the world, which suggests duality, is not true. There is but one God. I cover my eyes because my eyes do deceive me. I'm led to believe that the world has two functions, two powers that are at odds. No, I cover my eyes and I say, that is an illusion. I truly believe Hashem Echad. That's a deeper reason as to why we cover our eyes. Yes? Do you like that answer?
I'm taking it in.
Okay, great. Good. All right. Any other questions? Wonderful. All right. Ladies, gentlemen, we are going to continue with the Shema. There's really a lot to say. I hope that I'll be able to get through it all. It's like a course unto itself.
Yes.
And we haven't even gotten to Shemona Esrei. Okay. Well, we're going to pick up the pace a little. It's like, sometimes you can play recordings in a 1.5 or 2 speed. I'm going to see if I can speak in 1.5 or 2 speed and see if we can get it all in. Then you can listen to it in 4 speed and it sounds really good. All right. Have a great night, everybody.